Friends, what I have to say this morning is focused around two stories. Now, the first of those stories has already been read. Paul read that passage from Acts 11, that is, Paul Rowcroft read that passage from Acts 11, and it's a very brief description of significant events in the life and spread of the early Christian church. Luke, in his account in Acts, reminds us of the fact that early in the Christian era, there was a response of persecution to the Jews in Jerusalem. And as a consequence of that persecution, which we find in the Acts of the Apostles associated with the stoning of Stephen and things that followed, with that persecution came a dispersal of people from Jerusalem. Believers left Jerusalem for the sake of safety and spread over various areas, Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch. And however it was their practice as they went, yes, they took their faith with them, but they essentially shared it with fellow Jews. Because where they went, there were communities of Jewish people, and they found their place there. That was their natural identity, in a way. Though they brought with them a new message of grace and hope in Jesus Christ. And they shared that word in those communities of faith that were already existing. And Luke just treats it so subtly in a way. He says, but among them were some men of Cyprus and Cyrene. And on coming to Antioch, they spoke to the Hellenists also. These were people perhaps whose roots were not so solidly planted in Judaism forever. And they had this good news of Jesus Christ. And when a group of them came to the city of Antioch, they began to share the faith, but they didn't restrict themselves just to people of the Jewish community there. They spoke to the Gentiles as well. And the Lord blessed that. And there was a great response. And it became noticed. In fact, it probably caused almost a little consternation at first. Was this the right way to go? Was this the right thing to do? And news of this was kind of taken back to Jerusalem because there was still a continuing gathering of Christian believers in Jerusalem, followers of Jesus Christ, who hadn't fled at the time of the persecution. And so the leaders of the church in Jerusalem decided that they should take an interest in what was happening up in Antioch. It wasn't a day of instant communication. And they sent a young man named Barnabas up to, well, probably one might say investigate, but also to represent them there. And Barnabas came to Antioch, and he saw the grace of God at work. And Barnabas, as a man of faith, knew that this was the way things should be. And so he encouraged them, and then he encouraged them to be faithful to the Lord, but then he also realized that they probably needed some help and guidance. And who came to mind for him but Paul, or as he was still most commonly known, Saul at that point. And now Saul had an interesting history because he was a Jew, rigid, a Pharisee, but he had been a persecutor of believers. His home city was Tarsus, and Barnabas went off to Tarsus looking for Paul. And he brought Paul back to Antioch, and Paul shared in the life of faith in the community of Antioch. And as the account suggests, the response amongst Gentiles was continuing. And Paul spent with Barnabas a whole year in Antioch, building up that community of faith and watching it grow. And they taught many people. And Luke notes it was in Antioch that the disciples were first called Christians. It's a title that's served fairly well for the last couple of thousand years. As a means of, you see, distinguishing them from the community of the faithful in Israel, amongst whom they spent still some of their time. And so here was a transformation within the new Christian community that, while initially they had carried the message of Jesus Christ to their fellow Jews, it was now their opportunity and privilege and blessing of the work of the Spirit to take this message to those who had not been raised in Judaism and who had come from all sorts of different backgrounds and were, however, attracted to and constrained by the message of Jesus Christ. And dramatic things happened. And, you know, in a way, in a quiet way, this marks the whole beginning of Paul's ministry to Gentiles. This is where it all kind of started. Barnabas went and brought him down from Tarsus, and they went to work in Antioch. And of course, you see, for Gentiles, there was much they needed to learn, as there was for Jews also, because Jews needed to understand how Jesus as Messiah fitted into the plan of God. Well, Gentiles were coming at it from a further distance than that, and obviously needed help in understanding how this faith that they found attractive and appealing and compelling really fitted into their thinking and their living. And the story of the Christian church, essentially from that time on, was a story that involved not a ministry just within Judaism, but a ministry to the world. And of course, when we go back and read the gospel accounts that were written later, we know that that was the Lord's intention from the outset. So that's story number one. I want to put alongside that a second story. Now, this is an invented story. It's not a biblical story. It's just a story that someone invented to make a point. It's sort of a modern fable. I don't know who wrote it. It's been around for a long time. Anyway, I'll read it to you. On a dangerous sea coast, where shipwrecks were common, there was once a crude little life-saving station. The building was just a hut, and there was only one boat. But the few devoted members kept a constant watch over the sea, and with no thought for themselves, they were prepared to go out day or night to rescue those in peril. So many lives were saved by this wonderful little station that it became quite famous. Some of those who were saved and various others in the surrounding areas wanted to become associated with the station and give of their time and money and effort for the support of its work. New boats were bought and new crews were trained. The little life-saving station grew. However, some of the new members of the life-saving station were unhappy that the building was so crude and so poorly equipped. They felt that a more comfortable place should be provided as the first refuge of those saved from the sea. So they replaced the emergency cots with beds and put better furniture in an enlarged building. Now, the life-saving station became a popular gathering place for its members, and they redecorated it beautifully and furnished it as a sort of club. Now, fewer of the members were actually interested in going out to sea on life-saving missions, so they hired boat crews to do this work. The mission of life-saving was still given lip service, but most were too busy or lacked the necessary commitment to take part in the life-saving activities personally. About this time, a large ship was wrecked off the coast, and the hired crews brought in boatloads of cold, wet, and half-drowned people. They were dirty and sick, and some of them were of other races, and some spoke different languages. And the beautiful new club was considerably messed up. So the property committee had a shower house built outside the club where victims of shipwreck could be cleaned up before they were brought inside. At the next meeting, there was a split in the club. Most of the members wanted to stop the club's life-saving activities as a terrible intrusion and a hindrance to the normal activities of the club. But some members insisted that life-saving was their primary purpose and pointed out that they were still called to be a life-saving station. But they were finally voted down and told that if they wanted to save the life of those who were shipwrecked in those waters, they could begin their own life-saving station down the coast. And they did. As the years went by, the new station also experienced the same things that had occurred before. They evolved into a club, and so yet another life-saving station was founded. If you visit that seacoast today, you will find a number of exclusive clubs along the shore. Shipwrecks are still frequent in those waters, but now most of the people drown. Now, the story is a little cynical, but it points to a risk that always is there for the community of faith. That risk of being comfortable, sort of satisfied to be together, enjoying the great fellowship. And that comes, of course, with a potential peril that the real heart, mission, and purpose gets lost. And the Christian church has struggled with that challenge throughout its history. Sometimes quite successfully, and other times not so much so. Because, you see, that's what happens if the zeal for sharing the story is lost. And it involves our remembering that we have been called to be salt and light in the world. That's a part of our calling in Christ. And what did Jesus say concerning that? You know, if the salt has lost its flavor, what purpose does it serve? If, you know, what's the purpose of light? You don't light a candle and then hide it under something. You light it for the purpose of shedding light abroad so that people can see and be guided by it. And Jesus ended that portion of his sermon by saying, in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. And Jesus carefully adds motive there at the end, so that the motive is not that, how would I put this? Not that the life-saving station becomes famous, but that the Lord's name is praised. And we are called to be salt and light, as were those who in Antioch began to share the word of Jesus Christ beyond the confines of their heritage community, and to do so with all sorts of people that they were probably quite uncomfortable with in many ways. Because, you know, if Jews were converted to the Christian faith, they still brought with them a long history of background and customs with which they were very familiar and which were strongly associated with faith for them. And when they began to mingle with Gentiles who had become believers and received them as brothers and sisters in Christ, they had to struggle with the fact that these were people that they probably wouldn't have been very comfortable even stopping to talk to in times past. And that was their challenge, to recognize that God's grace was great and marvelous and intended for the world. It wasn't just for that inner circle of Jews who had come to learn of Jesus. It was for the world. And so these stories, one from the scriptures and one just written by someone to help us see ourselves, remind us that the church's role is to be a light, a beacon in the world. And if we lose that, then we've really lost the essence of who we're called to be. And so that becomes our challenge. Not to hoard faith to ourselves, but to share it in the world. Not to be content that we have, by God's grace, received this word, but that we, by God's grace, have been equipped to share it and to proclaim it and to rejoice in it and to celebrate it. And so I leave those stories with you. I know the one's a little cynical, and yet it's, I don't know who wrote it, so I don't know what their thoughts were, but it really, you see, is just a good reminder to us of what can happen if we become careless and lose sight of our primary calling in Christ. And so think on these things, rejoice in God's grace. So live and speak that you share God's grace in the world. And let us together as a community of faith in this place so understand our calling, that we are not content merely to be a comfortable refuge in the world, but a place in which we are equipped and encouraged and motivated to share the good news of Jesus Christ with the whole world. Thanks be to God.